From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. That's the sound of girls playing sports, running fast and hitting hard. It's the sound of tenacity and teamwork, power. You know, when I was their age, girls didn't play soccer or basketball or baseball, at least not in leagues of our own. Things changed with Title IX, and today we celebrate girls' strength and speed and stamina just as much as boys. Unfortunately, men's pro sports still dominate the world of televised competitions and commercial sponsorships, which is one reason we love the Olympics. For 3 entire weeks, women athletes share every bit of the guts and glory. The entire world cheers as they run, jump, swim, dive, hit, and kick. So today we're celebrating the competitive spirit of women athletes with a collection of some of our favorite interviews, something to listen to when you're not watching the Olympics. Our first interview is with Amy Mullins, an athlete, actress, and activist. Amy was born with a rare medical condition that resulted in the amputation of both her legs below the knee when she was a year old. But that didn't stop her playing sports. In high school, Amy held her school's record for stolen bases in softball. In college, she competed as a sprinter against able-bodied athletes in NCAA Division I competitions. She ran in the 1996 Paralympics. But the really amazing thing about Amy isn't that she has no legs. It's that she has 12. A dozen pairs of the most futuristic prosthetic legs you've ever seen, including her so-called cheetah legs. She says they give her superpowers.
The idea of having superpowers refers to a particular bit of enlightenment I experienced amongst a group of, you know, six-year-olds that I had challenged to come up with anything they could imagine, whether it was a cartoon character, a superhero, you know, an animal, anything they could think of that if I wanted to be able to jump over a three-story house, what kind of legs would you want to build me? And they were instantaneous in their responses of kangaroos and frogs and Google Gadget and, you know, all sorts of Japanese anime characters that I wasn't even familiar with yet. And immediately a boy said, but wait a second, why wouldn't you want to fly too? And everybody got so excited, including me. And you know, for me, the poignancy of that experience was the immediate and palpable shift in the way that these children would have been trained to see me, a woman who has to wear prosthetic legs every day, as disabled. That word has a lot of weight to it. And in that instant, I became somebody who was super able, somebody who had potential in her body that most people don't have. You know, I mean, and we're talking, obviously, theoretically, with jumping over houses and flying, but, you know, we're coming closer and closer to things that 30 years ago were sci-fi TV programs.
We should talk about your running legs, the famous cheetah legs. Can you describe those and tell me something about what it's like to wear them?
Most prosthetics, historically, always were meant to replicate the loss of a limb, right? So you model the prosthetic off of the flesh and bone leg. Well, if I was trying to be the fastest woman in the world on artificial legs and I didn't have to have human legs, it was like, why are we looking at them? Why aren't we looking at the fastest thing that runs? The idea of having this super energy efficient design in woven carbon fiber that mimicked the way the hind leg of a cheetah worked, and also the way sprinters, you know, sprinters run on the balls of their feet. So when I would switch, I would warm up and train in the shock absorber legs. And then I would switch to the cheetah legs actually to do sprinting or sprinting drills, because it's like if you were to stand up right now and stand on the balls of your feet, you'd realize you have very little balance. You know, you have to be moving. You know, so hamstrings go into contraction, gluteals, hip flexors, and it was the closest thing we could, as amputees, could experience to the way a sprinter really runs. And also, you know, I mean, I grew up on wooden legs, like a wood plastic compound. So 100% of the energy that I used to take a step was dissipated into the ground. Whereas the human leg, because it's a series of motors and springs, actually gives you almost a 240% return. I mean, it's an incredible thing to think about, that you actually get more energy back from the use of your leg. And this woven carbon foot gives you somewhere around 87% energy return. So you're still losing, you know, at least 10, 15% energy with every step, but it's so much better than what everyone had before.
I've seen you on stage in, I suppose, the legs that give you the greatest height, and you were wearing really stacked high heels also, and I think you said you were 6'1". You make a very beautiful, very imposing presence. Do you find that people respond to you differently depending on which legs you're wearing?
Yes, I do find that they respond differently. You know, it's interesting because even just people that I've known for many, many years who knew me, you know, at a certain height, who knew me at sort of 5'8", 5'9"-ish, and then to suddenly be 6'1", I find that sometimes it's apparent, it's disconcerting for people. Or they've actually been verbal with it, with telling me, gosh, it's just, this is freaking me out. You're so tall.
Well, you tell this great story about meeting a girlfriend once when you first got your really tall legs, and her response was to feel jealous.
Yes, she is stuck at 5'3" or something, you know, and she puts on, of course, she wears some major stacked heels herself, but, you know, she just said to me outright, but you're so tall. I said, I know, isn't it? And it was literally the first night I'd been wearing these. I was out on the town, so it was completely an exploration for me. I was like, wow, I really found that I had to move with momentum, because to slow down in the heels was like, whoa, I'm not used to this yet. And I was just laughing about how much fun this was and how much of an adventure this was and how weird it was to suddenly see the molding of the tops of doors in a different way. And she said, but Amy, but it's not fair. And, you know, to my surprise, she was serious. She was admitting an envy of that trait. And I have to say, I think it is an enviable trait. I think a lot of people would find the fun in being able to change your height at will.
Still, doesn't it strike you sometimes how very far we've come in this conversation?
I think the shift is nothing short of profound. And it's really been in the last 3 years. For many, many years, Anne, I had to sit through interview after interview and politely grin when somebody keeps referring to me as disabled. It's like, how can you with a straight face look at Brian McKeever, you know, the Canadian skier who is visually impaired and, you know, set the Canadian national record in his sport? How can you see it with a straight face, say that person is disabled because of their visual impairment? They're doing something on the same level as other elite athletes in the world. You know, that's quite frankly super ability to me.
You know, we've been talking about reconfiguring how we think of ability. You've also kind of pushed the edge in terms of how we think of what we think about beauty and what it means to be a gorgeous woman. You've also, besides running, you've also wound up working in the fashion world a certain amount of time. You know, you've shared the runway with supermodels like Kate Moss and Naomi Campbell. Your name has shown up on magazine lists of the 10 hottest women in the world. This is also important to you?
You know, it wasn't important to me, but when it happened, I have to say that there was a sense of a real coup for me. You know, I mean, I found it very interesting. There was a photograph by a photographer named Howard Schatz, and it's a black and white photograph, and it was part of a coffee table book he did called Athlete. And he had all the men wear black kind of boxer briefs and the women wearing black kind of Speedo briefs with a black sports bra, with the idea being that black, you know, it neutralizes any bumps that you would see. In other words, he was intentionally trying to take any kind of overt sexuality out of these photographs. He wanted it to be about the beauty of the human body doing these incredible athletic feats. And so it's a photo of me taken in the studio coming out of the starting blocks. And what was interesting was that Sports Illustrated did a feature on me, and they put this photo on their website. And it caused somewhat of a, you know, stir amongst certain feminist bloggers, you know, which was interesting to me because at the time I was the president of the Women's Sports Foundation and, you know, have always considered myself a feminist. And the stir was about this photo being too sexy and that I wasn't being heralded for my athletic achievement or my intellect, but you know, for basically having a great butt. Which, by the way, I did work very, very hard for. It was like, yes, actually, I kind of appreciate my body being captured on film at the time when I was training this many hours a week. And I found it very interesting because I thought, wow. So I've actually moved up to the level where I can be objectified like any other woman now. How interesting that I've come from the, you know, primordial ooze where it was untouchable to be sexy,
right,
as a woman missing her limbs mid shin down, and now it's you know, too sexy. I thought, well, that's I'll take that.
I don't know if you ever read when you were a girl a book called Ozma of Oz. It's one of the sequels to The Wizard of Oz, and there's this character in it. She's a princess, and instead of changing her gown every day, she changes heads. And she has this really gorgeous dressing room like every little girl dreams about, with a collection of beautiful heads. You know,
that is fabulous. I've never even heard of this.
Oh, there's a redhead with green eyes and a temper, and there's a sultry brunette, and there's a perky blonde. And
oh, wait, so the different heads provide different temperaments?
Yes, they have different temperaments too, so she can choose not only which head she wants to wear in which situation, but which persona she wants as a little girl.
Well, there is like that. My legs have that power for me.
Really?
For sure. Absolutely. It's funny, I got approached by a grad school project that was presenting something to Mattel, and it was about how, you know, they were shocked that 20% of the United States technically has a disability. But yet, you know, Mattel has ever done two dolls, and they've been, you know, it's kind of like Share a Smile Barbie or something that feels a bit patronizing. And I think the Barbie who used a wheelchair, I think, was only, you know, produced for a couple years. And, you know, so they wanted to do a Barbie that had changeable prosthetic legs. And I kind of loved that idea of it, that, you know, you could just picture the little playing card size box of carved
Barbie's
wooden legs,
right,
or Barbie's Karl Lagerfeld glass legs. And, you know, I think that the today's generation of kids are extraordinary receptacles to these kinds of ideas because they've grown up with Second Life and Avatar and choosing their own identities with how they bond through social media. And this idea of creating and recreating yourself and having these different facets of yourself is really tangible to this generation of kids.
Yeah, but the thing that's so exciting about talking with you is we may be used to that happening in virtual space, but with you it's happening in real flesh and blood.
Yeah, amen. Hey, woman.
To see photos of Amy Mullins and her 12 pairs of superpower prosthetic legs, visit our website at ttbook.org. And by the way, those cheetah legs we were talking about have just been approved by the International Olympic Committee. South African runner Oscar Pistorius will be the first person to wear them in Olympic competition. He'll be running in both the individual 400 meters and the 4x400 meter relay in London. Runners like Amy Mullins love the exhilaration of speed. So do race car drivers. Commentator Erica Monroe Kane is neither, but there was a time when she felt her life had lost its velocity. Driving 200 miles an hour was one way to get it back.
I wanted to drive fast, really fast. I wanted to drive faster than I ever had before. I wanted to be selfish and indulgent. I wanted to forget responsibility and the trappings of who I am, and just have it be me and the car. The year before had been intense. I had had the incredible highs of becoming a mother and all the wondrous moments that brought. This was followed quickly and cruelly by a terrifying diagnosis of cancer. And in both extremes, my life and my experiences were not really about me. Even in the worst moments, all that was happening was truly about my new and now vulnerable little family. Because as every parent knows, your life is not your own. I had a baby to care for and to think about. A baby who at that moment needed to be convinced to drink from a bottle, since my radiation-tainted breast milk really wouldn't do. Fortunately, my cancer was contained. The following months of recovery, I moved on to the more common challenges, those of a parent balancing a full-time, demanding, and unforgiving job. Yes, I was rewarded by my choices. And sure, I was still me, a loving mother, a dedicated professional. But where was the other side of me? The side that was bold, that was rebellious, the side that was fearless. And it was for this that I went to the Chicagoland Speedway. I wanted to be a woman who could, would, and should race into the curve, catapulting onto the straightaway. I wanted to be gloriously, indulgently me. I wanted to live a few precious laps as a race car driver in a Formula One car. There were 20 of us in racing school that day, 19 men and me, the only woman on the racetrack. Our instructor told us to trust the car, that G-forces would hold it onto the track. I realized that everything here was engineered for speed. Wearing an asbestos suit, fiberglass hood, and racing helmet, I climbed into what looks like every child's dream of a race car, my car, number 13. It was my time. I had a second of forgetting everything the trainers had said, and then I hit the gas. As the car sped up, the sound literally thundered around me. I moved off the apron onto the track. The car felt so powerful. I remembered the trainer telling me not to make any quick movements, that everything should be smooth. For a moment, I was afraid to turn the wheel. Then, with my face set and my eyes locked onto the track, I guided the car forward. I drove very fast, even in lap one. I could sense the speed and the risk in the small movements of the car. Then I began to feel the car, to feel how it was responding. I relaxed and began to take control. Going into lap two, I got a green flag indicating that I could go faster. I couldn't believe it. I seemed so near the pace car, and we'd been warned in training about driving too close. But I did not need to be asked twice. I closed in. As intense concentration turned to exhilaration, I could feel my car yearning forward, full of power and wanting to move. I raced, fully accelerated into the curve, up onto the banked track, flying above everything else, feeling that this is what my car was meant to do, and feeling the clarity of living completely in that moment. I flew around the track, this time riding high up along the stands, thrilled as I watched them rush by. I imagined seeing faces flip like slides, quickly but distinctly, capturing the expressions of the standing, cheering fans, who in a beautiful blur would remind you that your life is rare and that you are lucky. What I found was, I am not afraid. 140 isn't fast enough. And that other person, she's still in there.
Commentator Erica Monroe Kane. I'm Anne Strainchamps. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We're celebrating women athletes this hour in honor of the Olympic Games going on in London. This year, the Olympics will feature a debut competition, a women's boxing tournament. For the first time ever, 36 women boxers from six continents will compete on their nation's Olympic boxing teams, which many see as a huge triumph after so many years of being told boxing was inappropriate for women and could damage their bodies or even their minds. Back in 2002, I talked with professional boxer Kate Sekulis about women and boxing and violence and about her first professional match against a boxer named Raging Bell.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we were incredibly mismatched. I was overmatched. She was two weight classes or more heavier. She was 6'3". I'm 5'8". Her reach was longer, much. And also, she had a record of 6-0 in her professional career, 3 by knockout, and her manager was the promoter of the fight. So Odds were loaded against me.
We should point out this was a real fight, not you weren't sparring in this one.
Right, this was the first fight, actually. This was my first. And obviously that's the stupid one to pick for your first fight, but in a way that appealed to me. So, well, I've got to do it sometime, and this one, I felt that I quite liked being the underdog. I thought, there's no way I can only look good here. If she really hurts me, it's because she's so huge, and no one is going to really censor me for that. But if I'm good, then I get extra kudos because she's so huge.
So what happened in the fight?
It was overwhelming and it was great. I found that I did know what to do and I did, in fact, break her nose, as was confirmed later, although I had broken mine in sparring just before, so neither of our noses did very well. And, well, I didn't get the decision she did, and I think that it was a decision. And I feel now, at the time I was, everyone said you won, you was robbed. But they always say that. But I have watched that tape over and over and over and over again, and I think I might have won. So I felt good about it, because I did what I was supposed to do. And this time I really did let loose. I did not hold back. I was glad I was able to.
When you were in the ring in that fight, she hit hard. Neither of you was holding back. Did that change things? I mean, was there a moment when you felt, I don't know, bloodlust, like you just wanted to kill her?
Yeah, the one time I felt that in the fight was in the second round, and she sort of stood back. I stepped back, which is perfectly fine, but she kind of beckoned to me as if I was scared, and that's why I'd step back. And then I thought, well, let me at her. That, how dare she? And that was great. I really needed that. And then I cornered her, and I think that's when I got her nose, and there was blood. And you know, now to me it sounds very, I'm not like that normally, but certainly in that situation it's expected and it's a good thing.
When you write about being in the ring, your writing changes. You know, it gets kind of choppy and you use just fragments of thoughts. I imagine that in the ring your whole consciousness must change, and that's partly what you're describing.
Yes, and it was very interesting because it did and it didn't. I was in fight mode, definitely. I had the adrenaline rush. It was all as I expected, and yet I was still me. And of course I would still be me. I mean, you don't become someone else ever, but I think I thought that I would be more changed by being in the ring. But it was just the most vivid, one of the most vivid moments ever in my life, because it was just to be in this spotlit ring and to be the action when you've watched it so often, and to be in the position of being the entertainer for the crowds, and the reason you're there is to probably draw blood to beat someone up, and to be that person. It was so against the old me that I was so used to, the nice person. And the discrepancy between what I had learnt to become, what I was in that moment, and what I had got used to being of old was present. I was aware of that.
But that sounds like a life-changing moment, as you said, to incorporate
sure.
this other identity, to discover in yourself a woman who could hit, who could hurt.
Of course, all women are aggressive at some level. If we're not, then there's something buried. I think all humans have an aggressive tendency that can be dealt with in an infinite number of variety of ways and maybe quashed, especially if we're female, because it's socialized into us that we shouldn't be aggressive.
Well, of course, since you got into boxing, it has become much cooler, and women have moved into boxing in a serious way. Wasn't there a fight, a specific fight between women, a professional fight, that really kind of changed how women were seen in the boxing
yes,
world?
Absolutely. There was the first fight to be televised nationally. It was on the undercard of the Tyson-Bruno bout in, I think it was March 96. It was Christy Martin versus Deirdre Gogarty. And Christy Martin was the first woman boxer to be signed up by Don King, and so he had her on every Tyson undercard, and this was the first time that she got to fight on TV, and it was the fight of the night. The Tyson-Bruno bout was really disappointing, and the girls were the real deal. They were toe-to-toe, and it was a really exciting fight, and a lot of spectators at home and also newspaper reporters were quite converted by that. I think shocked at the quality of the women. It was not a joke. Did a lot for the sport.
Is there a risk ever of people regarding this as just titillating, you know, men getting off on girls with breasts fighting each other?
Oh, sure. I think that's always going to be in the picture. There's nothing we can do about it. If men want to view it as titillating, then that's their choice. And it's not particularly comfortable to dwell on it when you're doing it, but you can ignore it fairly easily, I think, for the most part. What I would hate is, and this has happened when boxing commentators, the more chauvinistic kind, or the writers in boxing magazines, treat it in print as a TNA show with blood. And that's really annoying, irritating. Cheesecake with ketchup, I think I called it somewhere. That is bad news. And I hope that kind of condescending behavior, which sort of seems defensive, I think that is probably on the way out.
Are the best women boxers as good as the best men boxers?
In one word, yes. And there's a caveat, which is that we are so much newer to the sport. I think the best women boxers very often came from martial arts background in kickboxing. But now that there's been a few years of practice and there are more women coming into the sport younger, and the amateurs are really quite healthy, and there's a lot coming up through the ranks that way, like the men do, the skill level is increasing across the board. If the momentum is increased or stays the same even, that there will be more and more impressive women boxers. And there is emerging a difference in style. There's a tendency for women to go toe-to-toe much more. The style is very often much more intense than the men's fights, and that is something that fans really enjoy about women's boxing.
Kate Sekulis is the author of The Boxer's Heart: How I Fell in Love with the Ring. Okay, this next interview is not about an Olympic sport, because there are no roller derby queens at the London Olympics. Though, in another 4 years, who knows, I could see the U.S. fielding a pretty tough roller derby team.
In the world of roller games, there's room at the top for only one. And there's only one Kansas City Bomber. And she's the hottest thing on wheels.
Casey, go, 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 Casey, go! Casey Carr up in front. The Bomber is at it again. Ladies, 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 let's be ladies here.
Hey, listen, Big Brother, you're a big, fat tumble on. You can't skate any better than you look.
This is the world of roller games, where the only thing more dangerous than the competition is some of the fans.
You people like to make fun of roller derbies, and yes, the women who compete in them do wear fishnet tights and very short skirts, but they are definitely channeling girl power in an ironic post-feminist kind of way. Melissa Jewell One explained it to me. She plays roller derby under the name Malicious.
All of the girls, no matter what size or shape or age or the persona they took on, each of them was very confident in the persona they'd chosen for themselves. And I really wanted to feel that way too. I mean, every one of them believes that they are the sexiest, strongest, fastest, most awesome. And I really wanted to think that about myself. And being around them made me think, well, if I create that persona, eventually I'll be that girl.
What's with the stage names the girls have? You know, Raquel Welts, Malice in Wonderland, Cherry Chainsaw. Why do they have these stage names?
Well, I think partially it started just for fun. When roller derby started, I don't think most of the girls who were skating really anticipated it was going to become a legitimate sport. So it was just another fun aspect of dressing up. And for some of the leagues, after the Texas Roller Girls started, when it spread, in some of the more conservative parts of the country, girls felt more comfortable taking on a persona and a made-up name, because then they could really clearly separate their day jobs and their regular lives from their roller derby lives. So they kind of were able to hide inside of their skater names so they could be normal at work and have this other persona outside of work. For me, it was really liberating to create a persona and take on a new name, because Malicious can do a lot of things that Melissa Jewell One really can't do.
Like what?
Malicious is much braver. I think the character that I really wanted to create is a lot more brazen than I am. And it's kind of bled over into my real life. I mean, if you talk to my husband, he'll tell you. There's no shy, retiring parts of me anymore. But in the beginning, I really took a lot of strength from saying to myself, okay, I'm just going to pretend to be malicious. She wouldn't be afraid to pick up the telephone. She wouldn't be afraid to wear the push-up bra. You know, whatever it is, from silly to important, it really helped to think about how a character that I wanted to be would behave in a situation and then adopt that behavior.
Well, let's talk some about the athletics behind roller derby, because it is a real sport with real rules, penalties, positions even. Is it a hard sport?
It's pretty demanding. Number one, of course, you have to be able to skate well enough that you're not thinking about skating at all. And I think that we all aspired to be like hockey skaters. I mean, if you watch ice hockey teams, they're amazing. Forward, backward, you know, able to turn in both directions, crossovers, the whole thing. They're not thinking about their feet. So the first thing we had to do was really work on our skating skills. And then once you've got that conquered, you have to think about how to use your body as a battering ram. So then we're kind of pulling in some stuff from football with body blocks and how to fall and roll and get up quickly. And then there's the strategy involved in the sport. When you first start watching the game, it's kind of hard to see that there's strategy involved. But there is some strategy in how you help the jammer get through the pack and when the jammer should speed up and, you know, attempt to score and when to kind of pull back based on where the other jammer is.
Okay, wait. What's the jammer?
Getting ahead of the game, huh?
Who's the jammer?
So there are three positions: jammer, blocker, and pivot. The jammer is the person who's responsible for scoring points for the team. They're generally sprint skaters. They can be tiny, but we've also seen really successful large jammers because they can kind of barrel their way through the pack. The blockers do what their name implies. They get in the way of the opposing team's jammer, and they also assist their jammer through the pack, making holes to help them get through so they can score points. And then the pivot is a specialized blocker who skates at the front of the pack. And the pivot's job is to control the speed of the pack. So if their jammer's coming, they want to slow down a little bit so that their jammer can get through to score. Meanwhile, the other pivot is trying to speed up the pack so that the competition can't score.
Which did you play?
I've played all three positions. When we first started, anybody could be a jammer. And as we got more specialized, I moved into blocker and pivot because that's where I was. I'm really good at getting in the way, apparently, knocking people down. There's also a lot of pressure on being a jammer. I realized at one point that I would fight to be put into a game as a jammer and then get to the starting line and ask myself why on earth I did that, because there's so much pressure to score those points.
Does it ever bother you that the whole girls fighting thing is kind of like a male fantasy on wheels?
I think that one of the really appealing aspects of roller derby is that it allows us to kind of take those male fantasy perceptions and flip them around a little bit. Like, we always referred to skaters as the girls. And, you know, I can remember talking to some people about that and them saying, well, why do you call yourselves girls? That seems so demeaning. I was like, well, we're calling ourselves girls. We're taking ownership of that. And, you know, you can call it third wave of feminism, or you can just call it having fun. I don't think any of us take that part of it too seriously. And we're happy to have the fans come. If some of them are coming because they want to see a sport and some of them are coming because they want to see girls in fishnets, that's awesome. We're wearing the fishnets. We wouldn't be doing it if we didn't think it looked really hot.
Melissa Jewelwan, a.k.a. Malicious, the author of Roller Girl, totally true tales from the track. She also writes the blog, The Clothes Make the Girl, where her motto is train hard, eat clean, live loud. I'm Anne Strainchamps. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Next, who says you can't be a woman, a mother, and a hunter?
I'm Tina Bertoni. I had taken this 225-pound bear in northeastern Wisconsin along the Peshtigo River, and I was there with my two boys, who at the time were 7 and 11 years old. You only get a bear license in the area that we hunt once every 6 years. And the more I got to thinking, I thought, well, I think it would be kind of fun to take the boys up. They had off of school, so I thought that would be fun to take the boys up with me, and it'd be a nice experience for them. The boys, because of their age, were probably not going to do well sitting directly with me. So the boys sat with one of the people that we were staying with. They heard the shot. They definitely knew it was my shot. They came rushing down the hill. They were so excited, and we all walked in and walked up to the bear. It was a clean shot. It ran maybe 10 yards from where I was sitting, and my 11-year-old actually helped the gentleman carry it out of the woods, which was a task because it was a large bear, and it's deceiving. People think of, when they think of black bears, they think they're supposed to be as big as grizzly bears, and they're not. They're big, but they're not that enormous 6 feet tall, towering over you kind of bear. Bear meat is my by far favorite game food. The flavor and the texture of it, I absolutely love. It's not gamey at all. It is not at all what you think it would be. It sort of has the texture of pork, but the flavor of a really high quality beef. And my kids absolutely love it.
Tina Bertoni lives and hunts with her family in Wisconsin. Now, according to some statistics, the number of American women who hunt is increasing. Some grew up in a hunting culture, others are newcomers to the sport. Writer Kim Hiss had never held a gun in her life until she took an editorial job at Field & Stream magazine. And then one day, the NRA invited her on a deer hunt.
I've never killed anything before. Bambi was my favorite movie as a kid. I mean, my family was shocked I was going hunting at all. Basically, the entire experience was very out of character for me.
Were you afraid you'd freak out at the sight of blood, or afraid that you just would see a deer but not be able to actually take a shot?
You know, it was everything. I was afraid I'd see a deer and freeze, not be able to take a shot. I was afraid I would take a shot, but I'd freak out. It would be a bad shot, and then I'd wound something that I then wouldn't be able to recover and basically cause suffering. I was very nervous because I just didn't know what to expect.
So what happened when you finally saw a deer?
It was late morning. We basically, this is my guide and I, spotted a group of deer at the top of a hill. So my guide had me get into position. And there were two bucks in that group, and he helped me decide which one made the most sense. As I remember it, the group had kind of bolted and then stopped, so I basically had a very quick second if I was going to take the shot to do so. And I did. That was a 245-yard shot.
So that's a pretty long way.
It was a very long way, but I felt that I had scoped it in well, and I felt confident in the moment that I could take the shot, so I did. So that basically stopped the deer enough for me to run up the hill and take a second 170-yard shot, which dropped the deer in its tracks. And it was over that quickly. Once I got to the deer, saw that it was down, saw that there had been, if any suffering, it was extremely short because the shot was extremely clean. I was relieved that it had, I don't want to say worked out, because clearly it didn't for the deer. I mean, you are taking a life. It's a responsibility, but it had happened as cleanly as it could have.
Did you feel bad about what you had done, or did you feel like, this was great, I'd like to do it again?
I had a very mixed reaction to it, which was very much at odds with the reaction my guide had. My reaction was very sober. Once I got to the deer, we knew that it was dead. Again, there was this feeling of relief, but there definitely was sadness mixed in. I did cry a little. I kind of cradled the deer. It was a very odd reaction from me. I was really trying to come to terms with it. So it was kind of a somber moment of relief mixed with regret, mixed with, clearly it's a difficult feeling to describe.
How did your guide react?
Well, that's the thing. The guide, on the other hand, is very used to experiencing in his clients that kind of rush, adrenaline-pumping reaction that some hunters do experience. So he pulled a truck around, slipped in a CD, and cranked up Queen's Another One Bites the Dust, and started cranking stadium rock for what he assumed for me was this moment of, you know, adrenaline, triumph. But he was really expecting one reaction from me, and I had one that was positive, negative, regretful, a little pride mixed in, a little relief mixed in. There was a lot going on at the time.
Do you think your experience as a hunter, even a first-time hunter, was any different because you're a woman?
I'm not sure. I know some people say yes, some people say no. I had a very kind of tender, somber reaction to killing the deer, which I, you know, would think if you're going to subscribe to stereotypes, that would be a more female reaction. But on the other hand, I have talked to male hunters who, after a kill, don't take a photo of it, as many hunters do, because certain male hunters think, you know what, this is not the time for pictures. I just killed something. I'm going to field dress it and take it home and get it in the freezer. So I don't know. I don't know how much my reaction had to do with gender and how much it had to do with just my own disposition.
Well, I know this is something you think about, you know, women and hunting, gender and
certainly
hunting. I'm just curious, you know, is it just that hunting isn't something women have done a lot culturally, and so when they do step into the field and pick up a gun, they are going to be more thoughtful about it. There's going to be this sort of faint feeling that they're crossing a boundary. Or is there really something intrinsically, you know, innately gender-based about women's reactions to hunting?
Public perception tends to be more surprised to see a woman in the field than a man. I mean, there's really no way around that. It is a more arresting visual image, definitely, to see, you know, a female in the field with a rifle and a dead moose or a caribou. I mean, it certainly does go against that Bubba hunter stereotype that a lot of people are used to. It's interesting that historically that has not always been the case. 100 years ago, women were arguably more of a presence in the field and for whatever reason kind of dropped out, only to come back recently.
There were more women 100 years ago hunting?
Throughout the 20th century, there seems to have been a sort of relatively strong presence of women in the field, which seemed to have dropped off mid-century and now seems to be coming back. And this comeback is what a lot of people pick up on as seeing a surge in women hunters. But if you look back at the 1890s, you see a lot of women in the field. If you look in the pages of Field and Stream, women are a very strong presence to the point at which they're on the cover. There's a women's department. So around the 1890s, turn of the century, women were certainly a healthy presence in the field. It's really interesting to go back through those old dusty magazine archives and see a bunch of skirts in the pages of Field and Stream.
It's really interesting thinking about that 100 years ago, people didn't perceive a woman who hunted as the anomaly that we do today. Because I think, you know, today there's something that probably seems culturally a little off about the idea of a woman, say, putting down her nursing infant and going out to shoot a brace of rabbits.
Another part of that I can say is that I have met a number of women who do hunt while they're pregnant, which is a very interesting image and a very interesting meeting of a role of creation and destruction. And it's that's a whole other topic that I think obviously a man can experience, but a woman bringing a pregnancy into her field experience is very interesting to talk about.
What do the women say?
They say a whole bunch of interesting things. I've talked to women who sit in a deer blind and say that they don't feel their baby kick any other time more than when they're sitting and relaxed in their blind. It's when the mother says she's the most relaxed and she's the most self-aware, and that's when she feels the most activity from her baby, which is very interesting. Another common thing that I've heard from them is that they're excited to be initiating their child into this tradition of hunting, even in the womb, and they can't wait to take their kid hunting when they're old enough to do so. So there's a very strong traditional element in there as well.
Kim Hiss is a New York-based writer and editor. Her work has appeared in O Magazine, Wired, Prevention, and Field and Stream. We talked with her in 2010. We're talking about women and competition in this hour as we celebrate women's sports and the 2012 Olympic Games. And most athletes will tell you that when you get to an elite level of competition, the real game is in your head. It's mental toughness that helps shave that extra hundredth of a second off your time or push through pain and exhaustion. And there is no game as mentally tough as chess. And just as in every other sport, women have had to fight for recognition in chess. Grandmaster Garry Kasparov once famously said that women would never play chess as well as men because, quote, a woman's train of thought can be broken more easily by extraneous events, such as a baby crying upstairs. Ouch. Those are fighting words for chess master Jennifer Shahid. She's a two-time winner of the American Women's Chess Championship and a women's chess grandmaster. She founded the X Chess Championships, and she's the author of two books, Chess Bitch and Play Like a Girl. One of the things that I thought was really interesting about your description of your own evolution as a chess player is you write that early on in your career, maybe when you were still in high school, you had a very aggressive, even violent style of play. And after one tournament, your father said to you, well, at least nobody can say you play like a girl, which I guess he meant as a compliment.
He did mean that as a compliment. He meant to say that my style was just really ruthless and that people, when they were paired against me, they knew that they had to watch out. But ironically, sometime later, I was showing my games to a Russian coach, and he told me that I played like a woman too hysterically and aggressively, and that I should calm down and take my time. So as it turns out, there is a way to call violent chess feminine as well.
Are there times when it works in your favor to be one of the only women in a room full of male chess players? I mean, haven't I read, for instance, that some women chess players have sort of played up their femininity, wore really low-cut blouses, you know, called attention to themselves to try to discombobulate the men?
Yeah, well, if you're looking for a date, it's probably okay. But in terms of winning the tournament, I'm not sure. I think it could go either way. Some men could be distracted, but just as many other men might, if they're playing against an attractive woman, they might think that this is their chance to step up and try to impress her and, like, you know, defeat her. So because the better the chess player, the more they thrive under pressure, I think that actually being an attractive woman could make your opponents play better.
But is this a charge that gets leveled against women? Didn't I read in your book that there was one competition in which a man complained officially to the judges and to journalists that he lost because of his opponent's low-cut blouse?
Yes, that did happen. That was a tournament in Australia. And a lot of times it doesn't happen officially. It happens unofficially that men complain about how they just couldn't concentrate because their opponent was so attractive. I think it's kind of just an excuse. Maybe it makes some people play a little bit worse. But if you think about it, women have to play against men every single game. So if there's some sexual distraction going on, they have it just as bad as the men.
Do you think chess is sexy?
I definitely think chess is sexy, yeah. I can't think of a better way to get to know somebody than to play them in chess. Because you've got a situation there where in 6 hours, you're going to go through emotions with your opponent that would probably take you weeks, months to get to know if you were trying to do it in the ordinary way. Victory, defeat, ego, aggression, defense. There's really a lot going on psychologically during a game, and I think that's sexy and intense.
You've played against women, played against men. Do men and women play chess differently, do you think?
I don't really think so, no. It's hard because there's not enough of a sample size from just my experience. I do think women maybe play a little bit more aggressively at this stage in chess.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's a couple reasons. One of the reasons is that the best female chess player in the world right now, who's also among the top 10 male players, her name is Judit Polgár, and she's from Hungary. She has an extremely aggressive style, probably the second or most aggressive style of the top 10 players in the world. And a lot of the top women nowadays grew up looking at her games. So I think that Judit Polgár has had a major influence on many of them, including me.
Of course, these days, publicly, there seems to be maybe a little bit more interest in the fact that there are women chess players. What do you think of the World Chess Beauty Contest?
Well, I didn't like it much. I had mixed feelings, though, because I think it's really great for people to see that there's a lot of women playing chess who are young and attractive and, like, fun-loving. But I didn't like the World Chess Beauty Contest because the arbiters were, like, top male grandmasters. And I thought that that could be really humiliating for the female players. They were voted on by people in their peer group on how good they looked. And sometimes the comments were unkind, like, oh, this woman doesn't look good in that shirt. Or so I thought that I wasn't too happy with it.
So what would you say to a young girl who's maybe just discovering chess? What would you want to say to her?
I think it's really important for a young girl to have fun with it and teach it to some of her other girlfriends so that they can have fun together playing chess and not feel like the only one. Somebody to take to tournaments, to explore things about the game with. That's really what I would have loved to have when I was younger.
Yeah, I was reading your book and kind of thinking about the role of women in chess, and it's funny thinking about the role of women in chess and then also about chess itself and the one female piece, the queen. I mean, the object of the game is to capture the king, but it's the queen who has all the power. Isn't there some irony there?
There is a lot. It's so weird. Whenever I teach kids how to play chess, they're always asking me, like, you know, which one's more important, which one's better, the king or the queen? It's true that the king is kind of the center of the game, but the queen is the powerful one.
And so here are all these men all around the world playing with, I mean, they know this. They know the queen is the most powerful piece. And yet they have these strange attitudes toward all the women, all the queens out there playing chess.
Yeah, well, most of them are getting used to losing to women once in a while. Even Kasparov has lost to Judit Polgar. And I think as a result, he's quieted down about, you know, why women are weaker than men.
Jennifer Shahid is a 2-time winner of the American Women's Chess Championship and a Women's Chess Grandmaster. She founded the X Chess Championships, and she's the author of 2 books, Chess Bitch and Play Like a Girl.
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place, singing, we will rock you.
It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Jim Fleming will be back next week. For more information on sportswomen, visit our website at ttbook.org, where you can also listen to hundreds of other past interviews and stories. And if you want to know what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook or Twitter. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with help from Veronica Rickert, Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and our indefatigable intern, Nayantara Mukherjee. We had extra production help this week from Joe Hartke. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.